Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. On today's episode, we'll be asking the question, what is literacy, with our guest, Kim Donahauer. I've been listening to the audiobook of The Grapes of Wrath. It's an immeasurable work of genius, but that's neither here nor there. Since then, I've been asking myself a surprisingly difficult philosophical question. How can I describe what I've been doing? Can I tell other people that I read the book? On the face of it, that isn't really a controversial question. Technically, I heard it. But describing it as such doesn't seem to communicate the intimate experience I'm having. I am paying attention to the words and phrases. I have stopped and made notes about things I want to remember. I do feel a tremendous connection to the story and its characters. If I want to talk to other people about it, the easiest and most efficient way is to say, "So I just read The Grapes of Wrath, man. What a great book that is." No one is going to accuse me of being a liar. So let me ask the same question from a different angle. Let's pretend that instead of listening to the audiobook, I actually did read it, but only one paragraph per night, every night, for, say, 3 years. And given how long it took, I never really got into the flow or immersed myself in the story. In fact, after all that time, I barely remember the beginning and I never managed any emotional connection to the characters. I just kept trudging forward one paragraph at a time until I reached the end. Wouldn't we say, comparing the two, that listening to the audiobook is more like reading than the way I actually read it? Wouldn't the audiobook be a full and meaningful experience, while the physical paragraph-by-paragraph approach be almost robot-like? When we use the term reading, don't we mean something more than just the physical act of seeing letters and decoding them visually? We're all comfortable with saying some people read Braille. Why can't my ears play the same role as someone's fingertips? This is an interesting puzzle for the philosophically inclined, but I can admit that it's just not that dramatic. There isn't that much riding on it. What if I claimed instead that anyone who listened to the audiobooks should be described as literate, even if they couldn't actually read? They get the same experience after all. They're exposed to classic literature. They gain cultural capital. They can debate themes, symbolism, and relevance. And what if I insisted that any school that graduates students who listen to audiobooks should be considered just as good as those that teach students to read from paper? If I claimed this was literacy, it would create a firestorm. I swear I can hear some of you screaming at me right now through the radio. The fact is that the word literacy has political power that the word reading does not. Literacy refers to more than just an ability. It refers to a kind of status. A literate person has more social standing than one who isn't. If you doubt this, maybe you too should listen to The Grapes of Wrath. It's one of Steinbeck's major themes. To declare someone as literate is to grant them a certain kind of social approval. This is why so many cultural commentators are invested in claiming that Black English isn't a proper language or that folks in Appalachia are somehow worse readers and writers than everyone else. Declaring both groups illiterate is a form of telling the society as a whole that they don't matter. Maybe they're illiterate because they're victims or because they don't try or because they're inferior. We've heard versions of all of these arguments put forth with the most bigoted vitriol. But the reason why people can't read or write for real isn't as important as the claim itself. If we designate a group as illiterate, we don't have to attend to them anymore. On today's episode, we're going to investigate the concept of literacy and immerse ourselves in the battle over its definition. Are you literate when you can read street signs or when you read Shakespeare? Or are you only literate when you experience reading as it matches up with those of the community around you? Is literacy a skill set, or is it a search for common meaning from approved texts that betrays identity, authority, and acceptance? As our guest will argue, this may not be the definition of literacy she lands on, but it is one that lots of people argue for. So it seems that I wasn't entirely honest in my framing of the audiobook problem. The puzzle isn't really concerned with how to describe the method I chose to read The Grapes of Wrath, but instead about how I want others to value my doing so. College professors like myself still hold that there is something unique and special about reading. Listening to an audiobook falls short of the romantic academic ideal. What I was really asking was whether I would lose the moral high ground reading provides and the status that comes from it. Am I less of an academic because I use an audiobook instead of a codex? For someone in my circumstances, a tenured full professor, the resulting social disapproval is minimal, even if it feels important at times. Admitting it here and now doesn't really cost me anything. But for someone who is already marginalized, who doesn't have acknowledged intellectual credibility, saying that they can't read can cost them everything. Knowledge may be power, but literacy is sanction. And now our guest. Kim Donahower is a professor of English at the University of North Dakota. She's the co-author of the books Rural Literacies and Rereading Appalachia. Kim, welcome to Why.
Thank you, Jack.
Please send us your thoughts about this episode to askwhy@und.edu. Share them on Twitter or Instagram @WhyRadioShow or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/WhyRadioShow. You can find links to them and find out how to send us questions for future shows at whyradioshow.org. So I suppose I ought to start the process by being honest, full disclosure. Kim, you and I are married.
For 16 years today.
Today is our anniversary, so on behalf of all of our listeners, I offer you my condolences. It's actually really wonderful to have you. I've wanted you on the show for all of the 10 years that we've been here, and so I'm super excited about this. And I guess I want to start really by asking one of the questions that I asked you in some of our earliest conversations, which is literacy is one of those things that people regard as a settled issue. They think of it as being able to read and write. So what's the problem? Why doesn't this work?
Well, it asks the question to read and write what and how and why. And that's where it gets complicated because the word literacy actually comes from the word literate. Literate was in use 200 years before the word literacy. So, and I noticed in the monologue, you yourself went back and forth between the words literate and literacy. So literate is a judgment call, right? Literate means you have enough literacy, enough reading and writing. And that brings up all kinds of questions about if someone is proficient at reading and writing text messages, is that equivalent to reading The Grapes of Wrath and writing a literary analysis paper?
So this conversation that we're all having now on the internet with our friends, I actually had with my students yesterday, that text messages are destroying people's ability to write and the internet is taking away people's sense of what real reading is. This is a question about the nature of literacy itself.
Right. And that's why I mentioned three things, right? So what are you reading and writing? How are you doing it? And for what reasons are you doing it? And people have very different opinions about the relative value of those kinds of things. So you're right. Text messages are considered lower status. They're also considered to damage, right, the high status. And you'll hear these stories of students using text speak in their papers for school and things like that. The idea that engaging in one type of reading and writing is somehow going to damage other types as though you couldn't become proficient in lots of different ones.
So there's more than one type of reading. And what I mean by that isn't, right, that we can read different types of text, but that the experience of reading text messages is somehow a different kind of reading, a different skill set than reading a textbook or a newspaper or something like that?
I think it is because it's reading a different code, right? So you used the word decoding earlier to talk about reading. So think about when our daughter sends us a text message that has some abbreviation in it that we have absolutely no idea what it is. Which happens all the time, right? And then when we ask her, she says, because she's 13, as though we're complete idiots, she tells us what that means, right? So you and I are proficient readers of the English alphabet, but it's a different kind of decoding, right? The same symbol system of the alphabet is being used to encode meaning in a completely different way. So she is more proficient at that, right, than we are. So it is a different kind of reading because the text is being used in a different way. The actual letters are being used in a different way.
It's interesting because when you report Adina telling us the answer, you also report that she treats us like idiots, right, which of course she does all the time. But there's that judgment. There's that social status, right? In the world of 13-year-olds, we are marginalized at best, a horror that should not be spoken of at worst, right? And so does that mirror the larger discussion of literacy in the culture?
It absolutely does. And one of the things I think it points out that's interesting is groups are invested in coming up with different ways of defining and practicing literacy because it can give them status over other groups. So if you create a system that other people can't use as well as you, it gives you some kind of status. And particularly if you think about the relationship between, say, 13-year-olds and the group of parents, they have all kinds of reasons that they would love to get one over on us and come up with something that lets them separate themselves, lets them perhaps look down on us, lets them communicate in ways that we can't understand what their text messages mean. So I think because the word literate is so loaded with value judgments, as you pointed out, right, it's about sanction. When you come up with these different ways of reading, it lets you gain that kind of credibility and it lets you block some people out of the conversation.
So there's at least two different things going on, right? There's the power that people have to have secrets, to exclude people, to communicate what they need to communicate. But then there's also an identity issue here, right? That literacy is wrapped up completely with how people see themselves and how others see them. Is this too part of the larger discussion of literacy?
It absolutely is. And of course, one of the biggest factors in trying to define literacy or literate is because we assess literacy, right? We assess it all the time. And you can look very, very far back and read about how there's a literacy crisis. It's kind of hilarious how hundreds of years you can go back and find what passed for popular media at the time arguing that we were in a literacy crisis, that, oh, no, literacy levels are falling. People can't read and write as well as we want them to. Well, that implies that you're measuring it somehow, right, that you have some kind of way to measure. And to measure something, you have to define it. And so you automatically start deciding who's in and who's out when you figure out what you're going to measure and how you're going to measure it.
2,500, 3,000 years ago, Plato famously wrote that one of the problems with writing is that it's going to ruin the young people's memories, right? That writing itself was a threat. How did writing become – and how did, I guess, reading and writing, I should ask, become a measure of status and power when in its early stages it seemed to be an end to the old ways, a disruption of the tradition, right? When Gutenberg invented the movable type, that people were incredibly upset about that. How did it become so important when it challenged so many different things?
Well, the Plato comment about writing is frequently referred to in my field. And one of the things it points out is that anytime you develop a new technology for reading and or writing, everyone throws up their hands and says, oh, no, this is going to make things worse instead of better, right? A text message is basically Plato. That's Plato's right. Argument. It's just about texting. It's actually pretty ancient that it became a status symbol. So the Latin word that literate comes from actually meant a teacher and someone who was well informed about literature. So sort of like an English professor, an English literature professor. So originally a literate, using that like as a noun, was that. Then gradually it started to slide into the ability for people to read and write themselves, and it became an adjective, a way to describe somebody rather than almost a job title. And as that happened, and as the technologies continue to develop, right, you can see that there's always going to be people falling behind. As the technologies for reading and writing keep changing, there's always going to be people who haven't yet mastered those new technologies, right? You've got the ability to decode the letters, but the new technologies are always going to make things more difficult. So right away, you get this sort of moving target of reading and writing enough.
So again, we see that the debate appears to be about intellectual capabilities, but it's really about power. Right, it's conservatism versus liberalism. I always describe to my students that conservatism means keeping things the way they are, to conserve the present, to be reactionary is to want to go backwards. Liberals, all things being equal, change is good. You progress forward, and it sounds like what you're saying is that these debates about technology are not really or not solely about assessing people's intellectual capabilities. It's about retaining the power that, let's say, the old guard will lose because they don't know how to manage the technology.
That's right. And so, you know, the phrase digital literacy gets used a lot now, which basically just means the ability to use digital tools to do reading and writing. And as digital literacy has become more acceptable and written into state standards for, you know, what students need to learn, that fear, that Plato's fear again, that we're going to somehow lose something, makes, as you call them, the old guard dig in their heels and decide things like everybody has to read The Grapes of Wrath, or as is common here, everybody has to read To Kill a Mockingbird in the 10th grade. Everyone has to read David Copperfield in the 9th grade without stopping and thinking, you know, why David Copperfield? Why that particular text? Is that still a good choice today compared to what it might have been 50 years ago? So you've got this sort of tech-savvy group that's gaining their status from their facility with the tech, and then you've got the old guard holding on to texts themselves, saying, but if you're not reading The Grapes of Wrath, and I can think of people who would say to you, and if you're not reading it on paper, it doesn't count as much.
You know, I'm thinking about what you're saying in terms of my own experience with the books that you actually cited, right? Grapes of Wrath, David Copperfield. I read all of those, To Kill a Mockingbird as well, in school, and I hated them. I hated Steinbeck. I hated Charles Dickens. I liked To Kill a Mockingbird my whole life, so that's an outlier. But it wasn't only until my 20s and 30s, and you know this, that I fell in love with Charles Dickens, and actually I only fell in love with Steinbeck in the last year and a half or 2 years. And it seems weird to me that these books that are so sophisticated and so mature are given to kids because they have kids in them. So how does that go so wrong? How do the pedagogical lessons, the curriculum, how does the teaching choices that districts, that teachers make get so off track if the goal is to actually teach them to read, or is the goal something else?
Well, I will say that this has actually been shifting, in my opinion, in a positive direction. So I was on the state committee for North Dakota to rewrite the K-12 English language arts standards based on the Common Core standards. And one good thing about those standards is they describe what students should be able to do with reading and writing, but they don't specify any texts. The original Common Core standards did. It would talk about Shakespeare. It would talk about Ovid. And we very purposely took all that language out because of what you're talking about. I think what happens there is a slide into a different way of thinking about literacy. So we often see literacy used as just a blanket term for you know some stuff about something. You can find books on financial literacy and emotional literacy and all of these things. And a really popular book a couple decades ago was called Cultural Literacy. Mm-hmm. And the idea was if you're an educated American, there's just stuff you should know about so that if somebody brings it up in conversation, you'll know about that thing. And the interesting thing in that book, there's a list in the back of what every American should know, and some of it is text, some of it is things like Hamlet, but the designated hitter rule is also in that list. And so, again, the slide of this definition just seems to become things that people with status might want to talk to you about and you don't want to look like an idiot, and it shifts very quickly away from, but what can you actually do with those things?
You know, Mike O'Connor, an old friend of mine from grad school who was actually on the show a couple seasons ago, he said to me when we were hanging out in school, he said, the definition of American should be everyone who knows who Michael Jordan is and what a Big Mac is. And what's interesting about that is that that feels more like a working class standard than Shakespeare, Ovid, whomever. Is the battle about cultural literacy also a battle about class?
Always, right? Absolutely always. And one of the interesting things to look at is how some texts, like Shakespeare, that now are considered very high status, very highfalutin, weren't always considered that way. There's a great book about this called Highbrow, Lowbrow, and the author describes how there used to be traveling shows and that someone performing a monologue from a Shakespeare play was right before an act performing with his musical saw. So, you know, just these very different kinds of activities all mashed together. And he charts in that book how it took a while for Shakespeare to sort of become this ultimate high status kind of marker.
We had the conversation a few months ago with our mutual friend Adam Kitsis, right, the Shakespeare scholar, who ended up arguing, much to my surprise, that there's nothing inherently wonderful about Shakespeare, that it's just culturally accepted that that's a standard. Does it work the other way? And what I mean by that is, okay, we have these William Sapphire-esque notions of what a literate person is. Is there a fight about and is there a list of things that make people culturally illiterate? And that's a weird question because I'm not just asking about the absence of knowledge. I'm asking about knowledge itself. The first thing that pops into my mind is the politicization of NASCAR, right? Like people who like NASCAR are either real Americans or hicks depending on who you ask. Is there stuff like that in the literacy discussion?
Absolutely, because what you're getting at is the word taste. And this idea that someone's tastes, first of all, should somehow be consistent, that you couldn't have a subscription to go see your local Shakespeare company and also be a NASCAR fan. So we have these ideas that someone's taste is an indicator of their intellectual capabilities, their literate abilities. If someone's a NASCAR fan, that tells you nothing about their reading and writing, right? So we also have these associations with people's tastes. We make judgments about people based on what they like or claim they like, right? There's that great line in a Friends episode where they're doing a quiz and and the question about the Rachel character is, what does she say her favorite movie is, Dangerous Liaisons? What's her real one, Weekend at Bernie's, right? So taste gets really complicated because people will claim tastes they don't actually have and hide tastes they do have because of that concern about status. I have a very good friend, Sarah, who we co-authored the Appalachia book together, and Sarah likes reading romance novels. And it took her a long time to own that and actually teach a class on it. She felt like she had to hide that. How can I be an English professor and read romance novels? So we have this weird idea that people's tastes should fit in a certain box, that if you like certain things, you can't like other things, and that that's somehow an indicator of your intellect.
When we come back from the break, I want to dive more into this social status and stigma stuff, specifically by talking about your work with rural literacies in Appalachia and in North Dakota. And I'll start off by talking a little bit about your Uncle Grover. So we will be back with Kim Donahauer and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Jack Russell Weinstein and Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm talking with Kim Donahauer about the meaning and nature of literacy and the entire conversation that surrounds it, including power, status, and stigma. That leads, of course, to stereotypes. And I'm going to talk very briefly about Kim's Uncle Grover, but I actually think that maybe it would be better if Kim did it herself. Kim comes from a family on her mother's side who's all Appalachian. The maternal line lives in a small town in Appalachia, North Carolina, Hot Springs. And there were, three girls and three boys, right? And one of them, Uncle Grover, big, tall guy with a limp because he had polio when he was a kid. And very Appalachian and very sort of visually what you would imagine. His name's Grover after all, so he could either live in Appalachia or Sesame Street, right? And when he passed away or even just visiting his house was filled with books, book after book of every type. He also had a massive bluegrass collection. I guess, Kim, would you talk a little bit about how Grover represents both the tensions of the Appalachian and also how that influenced maybe your perceptions of literacy? Because I know one of the perennial experiences of living my life with you is we'll be at some dinner party with new people and people will ask what you do and you say, oh, I work on literacy in Appalachia. And they'll say, oh, well, that must be short research, ha, 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 you know, implying that Appalachians can't read. And it's a very unpleasant experience and now I've grown to respond. But talk a little bit about that, and particularly about Grover and how he represents that.
So I think I'm going to answer the second part first, which is how this Appalachian family got me interested in this topic. So I, of course, knew that Appalachian people were traditionally represented as illiterate. But it wasn't until I was in graduate school and I read a book that described that in excruciating detail and ultimately made the claim that Appalachian people were illiterate because they wanted to be, because they were willfully ignorant. They didn't want to know these things. And that did not square at all with my Appalachian family. What my Appalachian family has is a lack of formal education. But there were certain members of the family who were huge readers and sometimes even writers. There was Grover, as you mentioned. There's my Aunt Lib, who joined the Book of the Month Club and got the bound set of Greek and Roman philosophers and actually read them all.
Which I still look at whenever we're at
Yes, exactly. And then there was my grandmother, who was an avid reader and who also wrote. She wrote poetry. She wrote songs. When her oldest son was in World War II, she wrote him a letter every single day for the whole time he was in the war. So there was a lot of reading and writing. There was being surrounded by books in the homes of any number of my relatives. And yet here, you know, Appalachians are traditionally represented as illiterate and sometimes willfully so, which, of course, lets people argue so they deserve it, so they don't need any resources. So to think about someone like Grover, he graduated high school. He knew how to read in terms of, you know, decoding. And his tastes, as we were talking about tastes, right, his tastes were eclectic. And they led him to any number of different kinds of books, a lot of history, a lot of biography. He also, though, owned a pocket Shakespeare, which I now have as well, sitting on my desk because Grover has passed away. He liked the poetry of language. I think it's why he also had a huge music collection. He was very attuned to the aesthetics of certain kinds of language, as was my grandmother, who wrote poetry, who wrote songs, who only finished the seventh grade. So one of the things that I think this points out as we're talking about definitions of literacy is that one of the ways people will get a measure of literacy is they'll simply look at education level. And they'll assume that education level means reading and writing abilities. They'll also assume that it means certain tastes. And as you said earlier, it's sort of ridiculous to assume that if you were forced to read David Copperfield in ninth grade, that you somehow will, you know, now prefer Dickens. That was not your experience at all until you came to it later in life. What's remarkable to me about my Appalachian relatives is that they knew about the stereotype and they just didn't care. They just went on with their lives and their interests, and it didn't mess with their heads. It didn't affect their it didn't make them nervous about purchasing a Faulkner novel, right? Maybe in part because they didn't have a sense of how highbrow that was considered. You know, it was a Southern author in my family. If someone read a good book and wanted to tell me about it, they'd talk about how good it is, and then they would always end by saying, but it's not Faulkner. Because they'd read Faulkner, you know. Whereas if you have a little bit more knowledge about the taste and the stigma, you'd be afraid of Faulkner, right? And there wasn't that. There was this sort of eclecticism that led them places, right? However, if you look at the literacy data for that county and you look at how it was determined, my grandmother in particular would have been listed as illiterate.
I want to pursue that thread, but before I do, I want to follow up on something you said in passing, which is because your relatives and, of course, many people they knew did not have the formal education, they read on their own and they really taught themselves how to read on their own. Is there a different experience of literacy for autodidacts as there is for people who learn in formal institutions of education?
Absolutely. People will develop their own methods of reading, which interestingly can sometimes be very similar to methods taught in school. my grandmother had a way that she would take notes on texts. And,
well, I was thinking about her Bible,
and,
right?
Right, and she would look things up in the dictionary. And, you know, she had her sort of methods of reading that she had developed on her own that no one had taught to her, but that matched the reasons that she was reading. And this is what happens in school, right? Students are taught methods to read to achieve a certain result that the school wants them to achieve. It's not self-directed, whereas an autodidact wants to really know about something. And they probably want to either use that knowledge in some way, or they just really want to maximize the experience of reading that thing because they enjoy it so much. So whatever methods they develop for doing that are going to really be in line with a self-directed goal.
Can you give me an example of what a method might be that your grandmother would have used as opposed to something that would happen in some schools?
Sure. So if you think about even just note-taking, right? In school, students are often taught – let's talk about a piece of reading that's not fiction, that's a nonfiction piece. They're often taught to underline the main idea, right? If the thing they're reading is an argument, they're taught to identify the evidence, right, so that they can then respond to this argument in some way. My grandmother's method was to notate anything that was of particular interest to her. Her goal was not to be able to restate the main idea on a standardized test, right? There was a reason she was reading that thing. She had her own set of interests. There was something that she wanted from that experience. It might be in a tiny little paragraph that in school reading, a teacher might say, don't spend a lot of time on that paragraph. That's not where the heart of this piece is. That's not where the sort of main part is. Similarly with reading fiction, you know, you're sort of supposed to focus on the main character and that character's journey. If you're free to really engage instead with a minor character and maybe even skim parts of the reading until you get to that part of the story, right, that's a very different than the school-approved process. But it might take somebody closer to the text.
I'm now going to take a sort of a side trip because, again, I want to talk about your work in Appalachia, your work in Hammond, North Dakota, which is a pseudonym of a town. But I also want to mention and ask you about something that I suspect some of our more attentive listeners are going to have noticed, which is that you don't have a Southern accent. And you don't have a Southern accent because your father, who was a radio person, worked it out of you. Talk a little bit about that. Your father is an amazingly wonderful man, and I love him to death. And he brought a whole different level of sort of this tension between Appalachia and non-Appalachia into your life. But that's also about status, right? So will you talk a little bit about that and about the question, the philosophical question that I actually have implicit in the question is how you speak, and the New Yorker in me was about to say how you talk, is how you talk also, literacy. What's the connection between accents, speech, dialect, and the literacy stuff that we're talking about now?
Well, this is something that's fascinating to me, especially because my father inherently understood it. My dad grew up in Trenton, New Jersey, a poor family during the Depression. He had a Trenton, New Jersey accent, which is unlovely. And he wanted to be a radio announcer. And so he went to night classes and learned how to get rid of his accent. And what he inherently understood is that just – so when you say accent, you're talking about pronunciation, right? That gets judged as literacy even though it doesn't really have anything to do with reading and writing. So when you think about dialect as distinct from accent, right, you got kind of three things. You've got the way people pronounce stuff. You've got certain words, you know, and then you've got sometimes differing grammatical structures, like in African-American vernacular English, the actual grammar, right, can be different. Only two of those might show up in your writing, right, the structure in the words. When you write something or you read something, you're not pronouncing it. You're not making sounds. However, sound is one of the major ways that people will decide that someone else is uneducated and that word illiterate will come up over and over again. And I think my dad knew that being able to speak what was called Midwest Standard when he went to broadcasting school was going to be a value for me. My parents didn't go to college. They definitely wanted me to go and to achieve more. And I think he knew that being able to speak that way made a big impact on how people thought about you.
I have to say for the record, and I hope they already know this, that I'm going to use a word that you make fun of me for using. I'm in awe. I'm in awe of your family. What your parents accomplished in one generation. Your father left school at sixth grade?
No, 16.
16. Your father left school in 16. Your mother was from this small town. Your father ended up going to broadcasting school, being a radio person for a while, and then having his own advertising business. Your mother ended up going to nursing school, worked in a surgery theater for her entire career until she moved up into oversight administration and then ended up retiring because she went as far as they let her with a college degree. And then you come along and now you're on Y Radio. It's incredibly impressive. And what they managed to do, what your parents managed to do with the support of Lib and Grover and John and the whole family, Marie, and is astonishing to me. And the question that I have is, can you analyze that economic class jump from the perspective of literacy? Does that tell us things about what literacy is and isn't and its power in our culture?
Absolutely. And to sort of continue with the issue of dialect, I think, you know, rarely do we watch someone read or write. We tend to judge people's literacy by talking to them and listening to them talk. Hmm. And so I think along with the sort of dialect training my dad gave me, lots of conversations, being interested in my opinion, the kinds of things we do with our daughter. You know, I had a lot of practice at being articulate, to use a word that has also taken on some issues in terms of culture and status and stigma. And I think often when someone is well-spoken, that's the first way they get judged as literate. You have to sort of dig in with somebody to find out what their reading and writing abilities actually are. So I think that was a big, big part of it. The interesting thing in my family is it's sort of generational. It wasn't just my parents. It was my mother's siblings and their children as well. Everyone managed to advance in some ways, which meant not living in the Appalachian town, right? And that's a tension that literacy can create that just reinforces this idea that Appalachians aren't literate. If you have to leave to maximize the opportunities that literacy gives you, then that place is perennially seen as illiterate instead of as this wonderful hotbed of potential literacy, as you're describing my family.
So this leads then to your work in Appalachia, but particularly in Hammond, North Dakota, again, a pseudonym, mapping literacy and all of that sort of stuff. Talk a little bit about small towns and literacy, the stigma, and how you argue that stigma just isn't accurate.
Right. So part of the problem is I think when we think about how literate is a community, we think about how literate is each individual within that community. And as though the community has some sort of wall around it, right? And there's no interaction around literacy going in or out of the community, which is absolutely not the case. So some communities are more isolated than others in terms of those connections. Some have incredible connections. So, for example, to talk about Hammond, there are a number of groups in Hammond.
Why don't you describe Hammond a little bit as a city?
Okay. So Hammond is a town of about 500. In central North Dakota. It's fairly isolated geographically from the four North Dakota sort of major cities, and it's primarily an agricultural community. There is one manufacturing plant there as well. So that's the basics of Hammond. The reason I started studying it is because there was a tremendous amount of literacy activity going on. And what I call extracurricular literacy, that term is not original to me, but it wasn't part of school. It wasn't that someone was doing distance education, and it wasn't part of a job. There's book clubs, And the local women's group sponsored a reading incentive program for school kids where they convinced all the merchants to accept scripts. So these kids would read something, come to the women's meeting, give a book talk. They would get this stuff that they could spend in the local stores. There's a number of rural women bloggers, which is a thing in the community. They got a grant for a community center where they had high school students teaching elderly people how to use email and how to use the internet. So there was just this tremendous amount, a local history writing group that produced a, I believe, 600-page history of the community. And so I was curious, you know, what was going on, right? Why was all of this happening there? And, of course, some of that has to do with the individuals, but a lot of it has to do with their connections to other places and people. Organizations like the North Dakota Farmers Union, who used to have a program where they would train farm couples to be what they called humanities couples, who were then going to sort of instigate programming around this kind of stuff in the community. 4-H, which actually is a great literacy sponsor. In addition to just the record-keeping 4-H students do, there's a speech component to 4-H that is also involved that connects to reading and writing as well. So it's incredibly rich if you look not just at what individuals are doing, but also at the connections they have with these other places, these other entities that provide them access to lots of different kinds of reading and writing opportunities.
So how do you measure literacy then? Right? Is this what scientists call quantitative measurement, which is mathematical and on a scale of 1 to 10, how long of a sentence can you read, which I suspect is a problematic question to begin with, or is it qualitative, which is much more ambiguous and has to do with people's reactions? Which is it, and can you describe the difference and why it's important?
Sure. For me, the only successful definition I've ever seen of literacy quantitatively in terms of if you were going to measure it by counting something is a scholar named James Paul Gee, who argues that literacy is your ability to do stuff with language and with text within a particular group, a particular social group. And he argues that you get your sort of native literacy or your first literacy, he says, for free with your family, sort of like a first language. And that basically the number of different other social groups you learn how to use language and text in, like every time you add another one, your literacy level goes up. So I kind of like that if we're going to be quantitative to say, okay, the number of different spaces and social contexts in which you can use text to do stuff could be a quantitative measure of literacy. Otherwise, I think it's straight up qualitative. Because
can you explain what qualitative measurement is?
So qualitative, the kind of research I do is qualitative research, which means basically I'm trying to create what's called thick description, lots and lots of description of the kinds of reading and writing going on in this community, what people's values are that sort of promote this, and what does it seem to be doing? What does it seem to be providing to the community in some way? Ultimately, I'm interested in the link to rural sustainability and literacy. So with qualitative, you are identifying different literacy spaces, so I guess that's a kind of counting. But then you're trying to describe not just how they function, but how they interconnect with each other as well, to get a sense of, you know, is this sustainable, right? Is it likely, can I make a prediction about Hammond that this kind of stuff will continue in Hammond? So qualitative is much more interested in understanding what's there, how it functions. The same type or level of literacy might function very differently in one community than in another.
Can you explain what that means?
So, for example, one of the book clubs in Hammond that I sat in on, the book discussion was really, really interesting, in part because the book was by Steve Harvey, and it's called Act Like a Lady, Think Like a Man.
Okay, so Steve Harvey, for some right. people who don't know, an African-American television personality. So we're in a North Dakota town, which is predominantly Caucasian, I assume. By the judge on your face, looking
entirely.
Face, entirely Caucasian. Not television personalities, and women reading a book written by a man about men and women's relations.
About how to catch a husband, basically.
Okay,
a manual for women on and for his target demographic, which is young African-American women, on how to basically catch a husband. And what was fascinating to me about the way they were talking about this book is they were identifying who he was, who his target audience was. They were recognizing the differences between his target audience and theirs. And they were looking for the distinctions but also for the similarities and finding ways and even personal stories that they could use to connect to some of his advice, whether to agree with it or to disagree with it. But what was fascinating is it ended up in part being a discussion about who they were and where they were and their relationship to what seems like a very culturally and geographically different kind of community. And I think in rural towns, when you're able to do that, when you're able to get a sense of not just what does it mean to be a resident of Hammond, but what's your relationship to the rest, you know, to urban stuff, to not just see it as like an opposition that's totally alien, it has nothing to do with me. I think that reinforces your sense of commitment to your own community and commitment to stay, which is part of the big problem with rural sustainability, right, is out-migration. I can imagine another book club that might discuss the same book or might never even choose a book like that. And the type of discussion would be very different and wouldn't get into that territory and wouldn't do those kinds of things. And I would argue that that sort of book club is doing something different for people, right, and for the community. So you could say, oh, here's a book club. That's great. Let me read about what book clubs do. Okay, I can – you have to really get in there and decide how is this one functioning? How might it be different than another one?
So was the purpose – of the book club to learn how to catch a husband? And I love that phrase, catch a husband. I'm assuming it's regional.
That's Appalachian. That's not from Steve Harvey.
Was the purpose of the group to learn how to catch a husband, or was the purpose of the group something else?
This group had all caught husbands.
Okay.
Right? These were all older women.
Older what age?
You know, I would say 50s, 60s, okay, something like that. And they were reading it in part as moms of daughters and in part to get a sense of trying to sort of understand the landscape perhaps for their children's generation in terms of these kinds of things. But I also think in part, you know, someone saw it on the bestseller list. I believe it was a bestseller for a while, and I think they thought it would be fun or interesting. You know, in some ways, I think it was kind of a random pick. But what was really interesting is what they did with it in the discussion.
Well, it's also interesting because if we're looking at the various cultural literacies, there will be groups who would have chosen that because it fulfilled a diversity requirement. Right.
Right. Right.
And it doesn't sound like that was a concern of theirs.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Okay, we've talked about literacy a lot, but we haven't really defined it yet.
Right.
So what does literacy mean? Is there currently a dominant definition of literacy? Do you agree with it? What's literacy?
In my opinion, there is not currently a dominant definition of literacy, and that it actually becomes more diffuse as the years go on. One of the things I always show my students is the test questions from the National Assessment of Adult Literacy, which is no longer used, but until I think 2005 was the way the U.S. got a literacy rate. It was an actual test that they would have people sort of like census takers go around and give to people. A third of it is math. A third of it is looking at documents like charts and graphs and things like that. And then a third of it that they call prose literacy actually involves alphabetic text. My students always resist the idea that math should be literacy. The sort of graphs and charts, they're not quite so sure about that. I think it becomes more and more diffuse. People define text in different ways now. So someone will talk about something that's entirely visual as a text to be read. And that's certainly an interesting analogy and can help us understand how people read entirely visual texts. For me personally, I think of literacy as the ability to do things with alphabetic text. I specify alphabetic to avoid the math thing because the argument for math is, well, it's symbols. It's a symbol system. And so therefore it's kind of the same encoding, decoding kind of thing.
So if I could read hieroglyphics, would that not be literacy?
Well, that's intended to convey language, right?
Yes.
So you would be, you know, literate in hieroglyphics, I guess.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, I say alphabetic text because I'm thinking English. Obviously, right. If a language uses, you know, if it has a different written structure, then it would be something different. I think of it as doing things with alphabetic text because I think the doing things is really important. You and I talk a lot about seeing students who can – okay, it's the radio. I'm putting air quotes around read something,
yeah, right.
Because they can come in and sort of point to the sentence that has the main idea in it. But as far as we're concerned, the only thing they've read it to do is to come to class next day and, you know – At least be able to point to that and not look stupid or feel stupid, right? But in terms of having something else they want to do with reading the text, other than maybe pass one of your pop quizzes, there's not a lot of doing there. So I like that word doing because the idea is that you want something to happen, right? And not just a sort of flat like, okay, somebody else wants me to do this for this reason and I can kind of sort of do it.
How controversial is your definition?
You know, academics like to argue about things, right? I mean, there's lots of
– I'm not familiar with that.
I have no idea. I mean, there are a lot of people in my field or in English studies who would really object to my specifying alphabetic texts. And when Sarah and I were working on the Appalachia book and we were writing the proposal, she said, okay, I have something about literacy. And she was very tentative for what she was about to say. And I just said, no quilts. Which was yeah. Our code for, you know, no, we're not willing to extend literacy into things like can you read a quilt or is making a quilt akin to writing? Is quilting a kind of literacy? There's people who would argue that it is.
And what's the argument for and against that? Because that's really interesting. And what you mean by explain what you mean by reading a quilt for those who don't know.
So, I mean, at a sort of basic level, there's a sense of, you know, certain patterns mean certain things. Where the fabrics come from mean certain things. One of my favorite quilts of my grandmother's is a particular pattern called Round the World. It's little tiny squares. She made it with a neighbor who was an African-American woman. And you can tell when it was made because a lot of the squares are like early 70s polyester house dresses, right? So you can read a story in this quilt. You can read the story of this woman and her African-American neighbor, which is very unusual because at this point in Hot Springs, there's virtually no African-American community. You get a sense of the time. You can get a sense of class and the level of poverty in terms of the pattern that was chosen, little teeny tiny scraps. You didn't have to be able to afford to go to the fabric store and buy fabric. You can get a story, right, out of this quilt if you know how to read it.
So,
You can write a story by making a quilt like this.
And so in essence, part of what the argument is doing – anthropology distinct from literacy, is doing sociology distinct from literacy. I mean, in the sense that the way you describe that to me, it feels more like what a sociologist or an anthropologist can do. I'm going to look at this material and I'm going to understand the context and the resources and I'm going to make judgments about things.
Right. I mean, for me, what distinguishes literacy is the language piece, right? And I think there's distinctive stuff there, especially so you think about we were talking about dialect, right? We were talking about accent. I mean, that affects literacy in all kinds of interesting ways that have to do with how people use language to assign other people certain roles, make decisions and judgments about other people that doesn't operate the same way in those other kinds of activities.
Okay. So I'm going to interrupt you because I want to ask you with an eye towards Steinbeck and the Grapes of Wrath, there are lots of writers like Steinbeck who write in dialect. And it's not just that they're writing to catch a husband phrases,
right.
But they're transliterating right. accents, right.
right?
How does the ability to read or not read those kinds of the character talks in this way, how does that affect literacy?
Well, this is where we kind of get back to James G's idea of the more different kind of groups you can kind of function in terms of language and reading and writing, the more literate you are. So as you will remember, we had a neighbor who was a faculty member at UND who was from Southern Alabama and who had a very heavy Southern Alabama accent. He was a geography professor. And at the end of his first semester, he got student complaints on his evaluations that they couldn't understand him. These were, you know, North Dakota, for the most part, native speakers of English. He was a Southern Alabama native speaker of English. And they complained that they literally could not understand
him. Well, you can't understand my father when he leaves a voicemail, right?
Well, yes. But that's the mumbling. That's not the accent. And so there's an interesting question there, because students will also complain about international instructors who speak English that's maybe grammatically perfect but is accented in terms of Indian English or, you know, Chinese English. And so
This is one of the literacy tasks of the University of North Dakota, right, is to expose students to people who have different accents so that they can function more.
Right, exactly. And so the question then becomes, whose responsibility is it? So if you think about our neighbor from Southern Alabama and the students, is it his responsibility to learn to speak differently, more intelligibly to North Dakotans, or is it their responsibility to just get used to hearing something different? I think in the example of him, most people would say it's the student's responsibility. I think a lot of people, if it were an international instructor, would say it's the instructor's responsibility.
Why the difference?
Because of status judgments about second language speakers, all kinds of ideas about foreign TAs and instructors and faculty, the idea that it's foreign right away sort of suggests that it's so exotic, it's so different, that there's an extra degree of difficulty somehow in understanding this. And I would suspect that the Southern Alabama accent wasn't necessarily more or less difficult for students than if they had had a professor who was from Bangladesh. It gives you permission, right, to not have to try.
Is this bigotry? Is this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, well, I thought that was going to be a harder question.
There you go.
Why is it bigotry?
Well, in part because if you want to think about literacy as the ability to master additional ways of working with text in a particular social linguistic space. Think about how much more impressive the Bangladeshi professor's performance is, right, than the student who is having trouble hearing something because it's unfamiliar. They're reacting in a certain way that they're perhaps not trying particularly hard.
And it's their own native language.
And it's their own native language, right? So it should be easier for them, right, in some ways. And, you know, I would argue that this Bangladeshi professor who has mastered these different ways of doing these things is more literate, right, than these students.
You know, I mean, to put it in the most sort of crass dramatization, you have this idea where there are these foreigners who come to the United States who can speak four or five languages fluently, but they speak with accents. Then there are people who respond, you know, learn English, you know.
Right.
And who's more impressive, right?
Right.
And so you've anticipated a question that I'd been planning on asking, which is there a moral argument for literacy? I mean, you asked whose responsibility it is in this context, and you make, I think, claims that I would agree with. Does that mean that there's a moral responsibility to be literate? There is. We started out by talking about stigma and stereotype, and I fear that if the argument is you are morally obligated to be literate, then what you end up saying is people who aren't literate are bad people.
Right.
Right? So where does the moral stuff fit in?
I think it fits in kind of the opposite way of what you're suggesting. So there was that interesting case, I believe, in Detroit in the schools where the students – I could be wrong. It might not be Detroit. But the students were not getting a good education. They felt like they weren't learning anything. And they brought a court case. And what they argued is that they had a right to literacy. And that was the word that they used.
Right. We had an episode just a couple months about this, inspired by the case.
Right. Exactly. And so no one should have to be an autodidact, right? I am sure the Bangladeshi professor didn't, you know, sit alone in a room and learn English and somehow do all of this without any, you know, assistance or practice or community support in some kind of way. So the question then becomes, I think, what is the obligation to provide people with spaces, direct instruction if that's what they need, access to various kinds of things so that it becomes possible to participate in lots of different spaces in terms of literacy?
So the moral obligation isn't necessarily to be literate. The moral obligation is to provide the structures that allow people to A, participate whether they're literate or not, and B, to become literate in the ways that they want to or need to.
That's right. I think it's an issue of access.
So which leads to what may be the last question, which is why are some cultures more literate than others? You know, we're raising Adina in a Jewish household, and Judaism is a prime example of a very old culture in which literacy has been a primary concern and the literacy rates have always been, as I understand, very, very high. Not necessarily why Judaism, although you can certainly use that example. Why are some cultures more literate than others?
Right. So I think part of it has to do with simply, you know, any culture is trying to create a sense of cultural identity. And there's lots of different ways you can do that. There's lots of different things that you can say, we deeply value this above other things, to create that cultural identity, not just for themselves, but to distinguish themselves from other groups. So we value X more than these other people do, right, which is sort of a natural human tendency. One of the interesting things when I was in Hammond and I would ask people, why do you think there's so much literacy going on here? The most common answer I got is, well, we were settled by Norwegians. And then people would say, well, there was one Swede, but mainly it was Norwegians. And one of the interesting things about Scandinavian immigrant cultures to North Dakota is I've talked to Icelandic, Norway, Swedish, people of Swedish descent, and they all claim that their country had the saying when they immigrated, we left the shoes to bring the books. Right? They're all making that same claim, right? It's clearly part of how they define themselves. Now, obviously, you have to, you know, you have to walk the talk. You have to actually do those things, right? But then it becomes, right, self-reinforcing. And particularly if you're a culture that is, say, at a disadvantage to the majority culture, such as the history of Jews, reading and writing become extremely important tools to protect yourself, right, against laws, right, other kinds of things. I was reading
pogroms.
Right. I was reading a book about the history of the Jews of Spain and how at the time of the expulsion, some of the major counselors and advisors to the king and queen were Jewish because they were so incredibly learned, right? So it let them try unsuccessfully to affect these kinds of things. But it does confer a kind of power, right? But it also confers a kind of identity that is also portable, right? And of course, Jews have often had to move, right? So you can leave the shoes and bring the books. The books are portable. If you decide your identity is rooted in the land, you know, like, oh, I'm a farmer and I really am who I am only when I'm in this space. That's not portable if you're forced to move. So literacy is cultural status, as a cultural value, as a cultural marker. You can take it with you. And it can make you useful to other groups with whom you may need to interact in ways to protect your own interests.
This also isn't monolithic in the sense that within cultures there's tension. You introduced me to a book that has, I think, my favorite title of all time, Reading Don't Fix No Chevys,
right?
In which it argues that actually in this region, right, it's the Midwest.
It's actually Pennsylvania.
Oh, it's in Pennsylvania where boys are socialized to do useful things like fix cars, and reading and writing becomes gendered female because reading isn't useful, it don't fix no Chevys.
Right.
And that's just idiosyncratic to culture, although the history of misogyny and sexism seems to be universal.
Right.
I guess then this would be the last question. As a social and political project, as a project for, let's say, America as opposed to the world, as a literacy scholar, what are the things that we can do to cultivate literacy or to know which literacies to cultivate? Or do we not? Is there no – I mean, you said the moral obligation is to create the opportunities and the structures. So following through that moral obligation, what can be done, what should be done?
I mean, when you talk about predicting, obviously literacy is very much connected to economic success, and more jobs involve a lot of reading and writing. It is very hard to predict what those literacies are going to be.
So what you mean by that is we don't know what the literacies of the future will be. So we can say you need to learn this computer platform, but in 5 years, 20 years, maybe it's all artificial intelligence and we're just hanging out on the beach.
Exactly.
The North Dakota beach, of
course.
Yes, yeah.
Well, yeah. Yes. And so, you know, you can't really predict those kinds of things. So I think instead it's useful to look at what are the kinds of reading and writing experiences that are meaningful to people right now. We have a tendency in school to always look to the future, to say we must train people in these things so that in the future they will be able to do these other things. What can reading and writing, different types, different kinds of things in different ways for different reasons, what can that do for people right now where they are? How can it enrich their lives? How can it make their lives better? And to try to either pump that up if it already exists in some little minuscule form, or to provide exposure to some different possibilities so that if someone doesn't have a deep connection or relationship with reading and writing, that they can develop one. And it may not mean they get a good grade on the ACT, but who cares?
With that in mind, we have to stop. I know when we were driving here before the show, we had a conversation that as a married couple on the radio, we were aiming more for the thin man than for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. So hopefully we have succeeded in that. This has been a dream of mine for 10 years to have you on the show, Kim. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Jack.
You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Kim Donahower on Why Philosophical Discussions of Everyday Life. I'll be back with a few thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Y Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussion About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with Kim Donahower about literacy and asking the question, what is literacy? It's a funny thing to be an academic because there are all these words that you use, that you take for granted, that you think you know what you're talking about, and then you meet someone whose specialization is entirely geared towards saying this word means nothing, this word means everything, this word has 20,000 people who have been fighting for 150 years about this word. And academia has two kinds of people, right? The people who find that specialization intimidating and makes them feel stupid, and then the kind of people who find that kind of specialization exciting because there's a whole world out there that you can learn about. And I'm certainly the second. I know Kim is as well, and that's the beauty of this show. What we try to do is point out there's something that we take for granted and show that there is a universe of people who are engaged in figuring out what it means, how it works, and what its consequences are. Literacy is a word, as much as any word I've used in the last 10 years of the show, that is a political fault line. Our schools are failing. Our teachers are failing. Our government is failing. Our kids are failing. Our parents are failing. All of that gets subsumed into this concept that there is this thing called literacy. It is measured. It is objectively good, and you have to reach a certain standard. And what we talked about today is the fact that it's just not that simple, that literacy is indeed about power and acceptance and sanction, but it's also about communities and that within a community there will be different definitions of literacy and different purposes of literacy. We can have an umbrella discussion about literacy for this kind of conversation. But the bottom line is that if you try to create a universal umbrella notion that encapsulates all of the social and political ideals within it, what you end up doing is just marginalizing people and insulting people. And if literacy has shown us anything, it's that it's about community relations and upward mobility, that it's about working with your equals and trying to make yourself better, trying to make yourself secure, trying to make yourself loved. Literacy is an identity issue, and it's how you write and read and communicate the things that are the most important to you, the people you know, and the places you want to go. If there's no other message from this particular episode, it's this. When people tell you there is a standard for literacy, they're actually talking about something else and they are using it for their own purposes. You may agree with those purposes, you may not, but the next task is to figure out what those purposes are. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Thanks for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.